This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. Sunday morning, I was driving north on Route 100 when I spotted a stand of birch trees bending to the left and to the right, just as Robert Frost had described in his poem Birches that he wrote about 100 years ago. And like he described, the trees were loaded with ice on a sunny winter morning. Oh, to experience something akin to what served as a muse for one as great as Robert Frost. It was pretty exhilarating. Robert Frost had the innate ability to describe in poetic verse the beauty and wonder that those living in New England get to experience on a daily basis. But who was this man? Was he a simple, rural New Englander with an amazing ability to describe the beauty around him? Was he worldly and cosmopolitan, but willing to live quietly in New Hampshire and Vermont? Or was he the monster of egotism that biographer Lawrence Thompson described him as? The truth of Frost's character can be found in his personal writings, and a new project from Harvard University Press aims to publish the complete letters of Frost, thousands of them, in several volumes. My guest today is Donald Sheehy. He's the co-editor of The Letters of Robert Frost and a professor of English at Edinburgh University of Pennsylvania. Donald Sheehy, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Rick. My pleasure to be here.
Now, you're a Frost scholar, but you're drawn equally to his writing and his biography. What does studying his life add to your understanding and appreciation of his writing?
Well, I think it's true of any writer that no one writes in a vacuum, that writers are people living in an actual place and an actual time and confronting daily obstacles as well as the larger challenges of creating art. So it seems to me impossible to not consider the life of a poet when one is reading his works.
Now, you're working on his letters. They're personal by definition, not intended for publication. And taken as a whole, what do Frost's letters reveal about his style and his intellect?
Well, two things come immediately to mind, and that is the way in which that style changes over the years. Readers of the first volume will find in Frost's early correspondence a formality that speaks more of the late 19th century than it does of the 20th. And along with that, that we've given some facsimiles of handwriting that looks much more like the formal and elaborate penmanship of the 19th century.
He had beautiful handwriting.
He did at various times. His mother would have been proud of his early handwriting. By the end, it had deteriorated as it does for us all, into some pretty indecipherable scratches. But the other thing that you notice right away as you read Frost's letters is how interested he is in the person at the other end of the correspondence. Frost's tone, his range of reference, his willingness to joke, his level of overt sincerity changes from correspondent to correspondent. And you almost feel like you are listening into a conversation.
Also, but though his intellect, the breadth of subjects that he could write about was quite interesting.
Well, I will be honest and tell you that I would not have wanted to take this project on in an age before Google, because Frost's range of reference is simply extraordinary. And it would take hours in a library searching down references to obscure 16th century poems or references to the latest development in archaeology, so that you really are taken on a kind of adventure of the mind, and you also get a sort of social history of the time and place. Frost is a very observant correspondent, and there is always something of interest being offered other than what he himself might need to communicate.
So how does reading his personal letters give us a better picture of who this man was?
Well, I think that what we'd hope would happen as readers pick up this volume is that they would start with a kind of clean slate. Thompson's biography and the controversy that surrounded it The vast familiarity of Frost to readers in his later life, everyone comes to Frost with a kind of preconception. We're hoping that these letters allow you to get to know the man, to see into his life and mind without those preconceptions. So in some ways, it's kind of an autobiography of the mind that you meet in the letters. And what you find is that he was simply an interesting man. People gravitated to him. He was a successful teacher. Once he went on the poetry reading circuit, he was enormously successful and popular. There's a real force of personality that you cannot miss.
Listeners, what is your impression of Robert Frost, the man? And how does a poet's life and personality affect the way you read his or her poetry? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Donald Sheehy, large and small collections of Robert Frost's letters are housed in university special collections around the country. So why is it valuable to create one complete repository of his letters like you're doing?
Well, two reasons, I think. One, the publication of a writer's collected letters is kind of signal of his or her permanence. Harvard bringing out all of the primary documents that we have available for Frost serves as a kind of testimony and a solidification of his stature and his reputation. The other thing is that in order to read Frost's correspondence to this point, one would have to have had five or six different volumes open on a desk in front of one, jumping back and forth, trying to figure out into what chronological order they might fall. And even with the five or six volumes that were at one time in print, we're discovering thousands of previously unpublished letters. So bringing it all together in one place is a resource for scholars. It's a kind of companion to casual readers of his poetry. It's also a pleasure to just dip into.
Now, your original idea was to have four volumes. That has grown, is that right?
Well, the original idea was for three, and you'll actually see some reviews that talk about three volumes, because as close as we were to publication, we were still trying to decide how to divide it. Now it looks like five.
Wow. Now, Frost was born in 1874, and this first volume of letters goes through 1920. This was when Frost was just achieving full success as a poet in his 40s. Remind us of some of the pivotal events in his childhood and his adolescence that influenced who he becomes later.
Much of the drama and romance of Frost's life is contained in this first volume, because although it stops only 6 or 7 years into his career, he was, as you suggest, already in his middle 40s. So I would say that readers will be taken by his decision when he left high school after achieving great academic success in high school. He was valedictorian. He wrote for the school magazine. He was seemingly destined for a successful collegiate career. But despite the fact that his grandfather was paying for his education at Dartmouth, Frost left after one semester, never went back to finish a college degree, even though he did spend some time as a special student at Harvard. Here he was, young man, just graduated from high school with a tradition of education in his family. His father went to Harvard. And instead of launching into a career in law or following his grandfather into the management of textile mills, instead he decides that he wants to farm. So as the 20th century is moving from town to city and from agriculture to industry, Frost is moving in the opposite direction. The second choice that is truly striking is a similar decision made about 10 years later. Frost has, in his years in Derry, become a very successful teacher. He's attracted the attention of New Hampshire education officials. He's done model teaching. He's traveled around the state. He gets an appointment. He's invited to teach psychology at the normal school. So he's moved from secondary education up into higher education. And yet he decides that he will sell the farm, give up the job, pack up his family, wife and four children, and go to England in hopes of launching a literary career that had been long delayed. Making the trip without even a sense of where they would stay once they landed. It was, as his granddaughter suggests in a wonderful book she wrote a few years ago, it was an adventure, an adventure in poetry. And it's impossible not to be just sort of taken up by the sheer extravagance of it. And that it works is a kind of storybook miracle.
Well, as at the time that he was a teacher and a farmer, all the while he's nurturing the idea of becoming a poet, was there someone in his life encouraging that idea? And how does he describe that to friends with whom he's corresponding at the time?
Well, the person in his life who does most to nourish that hope and who never loses faith in his ability as a poet is, of course, Eleanor, his wife. Mm-hmm. She is, as Frost says in a letter to Lewis Untermyer, the unspoken half of all that he had ever written, so that her faith in his ability as a poet never wavers. The one person on the outside who gives him a kind of lifeline into a life in poetry is a woman named Susan Hayes Ward, who was for a while the poetry editor of The Independent, sister of William Hayes Ward, who was the editor of the magazine. And for 15 or 20 years, Frost writes to her with his hopes about becoming a poet. The Independent publishes a number of his poems, and she really is his one sort of secure contact with that literary world. If she hadn't taken such an interest, it's hard to picture what might have happened for Frost, because it really did allow him to continue to think of himself as a working poet.
Now, as you mentioned, in 1912, he makes a fairly radical decision. He uproots his wife, the children, they sail to England, and he's determined to become a poet there. He has no real plan, he has no connections, no reputation to precede him. In hindsight, it appears gutsy and worthwhile, but at the time, Donald Sheehy, what was he thinking? Right?
That was a question that a number of his friends and employers were asking him. Ernest Silver, who had brought him to Plymouth to teach in the normal school, was simply dumbfounded. How can you do this? Why is it even necessary to do this? Go for the summer. He really did have a sense that he had reached a point in his life where it was all or nothing. And they had sold the farm, so there was a little bit of cash there. And I think if he'd gone and stayed until the money ran out and nothing had come of it, they would have gone back. He would have resumed teaching and simply picked up his life where he had left off. Mm. So it was an extraordinary gamble. And the fact that he pulls it off, and the fact that in the space of 2 years he's established a major reputation, and not even with the book that he had pretty much written before he went over. The book that makes his reputation, North of Boston, is written almost entirely in that first year in England. So he not only goes to England to become a poet, he publishes what he was as a poet and becomes a new one in the space of a year. It's still the creation of North of Boston is still one of the great mysteries and triumphs of American literature.
And he draws literary acclaim. So what do his letters from these years in England reveal about how he handles these first brushes with success as a poet?
Well, as he would tell you, and as he told John Bartlett, success as a poet in England at the time meant selling a couple of hundred copies of a book, and being reviewed in a London literary circle that, while it had many sort of illustrious members, was a very small world. Frost happened to meet Frank Flint at the poetry at Monroe's Poetry Bookshop. Flint introduces him to Pound. Pound says, "Hey, we're going to go see William Butler Yeats. Why don't you come along for the evening?" And that's really how he forms a circle of acquaintances, because it was a very small world. And Frost knew that success as a poet, what did he say, butters no parsnips, that he was going to have to sell more than a couple of hundred books to make his way as a professional writer.
A far cry from a few million YouTube hits, huh?
Yes.
Now, he and his family returned to the U.S. in 1915. World War I is erupting, and he has to navigate newfound fame. How does he react to the editors and the publishers who at one time rebuffed him, and now they're courting him?
It's another extraordinary stroke of good fortune, and we like to look at Frost's life and say, yes, good fortune, but earned over the course of a couple of decades. But what he couldn't know was that not only was he coming back to the U.S. Under a little bit of duress, the plan to leave England had been sped up by the war. He was leaving behind close friends But when he arrived in New York, he found that a review of his work had been written and published by Amy Lowell, that had caught the attention of the wider poetry reading public. So it was almost as though the way was paved for him. Mm-hmm. And once he began to meet editors and give talks at local schools or readings, it was the sheer sort of force of his personality, the solidness of his authenticity, I guess you would call it, attracted people, and they began to seek him out. Frost did not, except for a very brief time where he was simply trying to get to know who he should talk to, Frost did not go out seeking all of these contacts. They came and found him.
I'm Rick Zingari, and this is Vermont Edition. It's been just over 50 years since poet Robert Frost died. In that time, millions have come to know the verse that introduces a reader to the natural rural surroundings of New England. But at the same time, many have learned about the man behind the poetry in the biography that was written about Frost by Lawrence Thompson. And the picture painted by Thompson was not very positive. Now, as a matter of fact, it was pretty ugly. Today, we're discussing Frost as a man with Donald Sheehy. He's a Frost scholar and a co-editor of the new book, The Letters of Robert Frost, Volume 1. Now, Donald Sheehy, since his death in 63, Frost's legacy has been debated, scarred, largely because of this biography by Lawrence Thompson. So explain the circumstances of Thompson's biography of Frost and how it led to what Frost scholars call the monster myth.
Well, Thompson was a very young man when he and Frost met. He was training as a librarian. He was a collector of Frost, did a little work on a bibliography of Frost. But he came into Frost's life at a crucial juncture. Robert Newdick, who had been working on a biography, had passed away unexpectedly. Frost was looking for someone to work on a biography, but someone who would take the approach that Frost preferred, which was a kind of old-fashioned 19th-century biography of the public life. In 1938, Frost also loses his wife, and Eleanor's death devastates him. So it turns out that Thompson is interviewing Frost and getting to know Frost and listening to Frost tell the story of his life at a time when Frost himself is full of confusion, self-doubt, anger, and giving a version of his life that is intended in some ways to punish himself. So that Thompson, during the first few years of the biography, gets this account of Frost's life that's deeply colored by the death of Eleanor and Frost's attempt to regain his balance. Well, the second thing that contributes is that Thompson was appointed as the biographer in 1938. He doesn't get to publish the first volume of the biography until 1966. So that the 25 years he spends collecting notes, traveling with Frost, doing interviews, and as Frost's stories of his own life changed over the years, Thompson began to suspect that Frost was what he later called a myth maker, that he was inventing these versions of his life, and that they were often in contradiction. So that I think what happens is that Thompson is, by the end, simply overwhelmed. Mm. He's got an ambivalent relationship with Frost, loved him deeply, but also saw the flaws that you see living and working with someone, saw that the public image of Frost was not accurate, and decided that he would write a kind of balanced biography. And that was his hope throughout, that what he was doing was showing how hard it was for Frost to become the poet he became. But what he didn't realize is that in breaking down what he saw as the public myth, he was going far, far too far in the other direction.
Well, how selective was Thompson in presenting primary sources from Frost's letters to bolster his hypothesis?
Well, that's the thing. Thompson had access to an enormous body of material, had more privileged access to Frost than anyone. So the first two volumes of the biography are just full of documentary evidence, but always presented with a kind of interpretive slant. I wrote a piece a number of years ago. I worked with Thompson's papers when I was a graduate student at the University of Virginia. And what I learned, shockingly in a way, was that as he's writing the first volume of the biography, he's kind of throwing his hands in the air and saying, I don't know if I've got this right. And then he starts to read books about psychology. And he particularly reads a book called Neurosis and Human Growth. And he starts frantically, you can feel it, taking notes in the margin. This is Frost, this is Frost. And he goes back and revises the first volume of the biography and presents a portrait of Frost as a classical case of neuroses. He even takes the chapter headings from that book and turns them into index entries, so that he ended up doing a kind of case study rather than simply trying to resolve his own ambivalence toward Frost.
Well, Donald Sheehy, why then does the idea of Frost as a nasty, egotistical, careerist liar persist all these years?
Well, that's a question I wish I had an answer for. Hmm. I've found over the years that a lot of people who base their view of Frost on Thompson's biography have not read Thompson's biography. it's almost as though once the hero was shown to have feet of clay, people naturally assume the worst. Oh, yeah, Frost. Well, everybody thought he was such a nice guy. Turns out he was really anything but. And there's almost a kind of inevitable backlash when anything negative is revealed about someone who's been revered. And then once it gets lodged, it's very difficult to displace.
Indeed, it is. Listeners, what do you make of the monster myth of Robert Frost and how it has persisted? You can join the discussion by calling 1-800-639-2211. Let's take a call now from Patrick from South Stratford. Patrick, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Well, my question is listening to the way I've gotten the book, and I'm excited to read it, but listening to the way that the book has been marketed, it's been marketed as a reaction to the biography to Thompson. And given that I guess himself stated that there have been so few people who at this point who've probably read Thompson's biography, I kind of question the usefulness of marketing it that way, and whether we're not going a little too too far the opposite direction. And then I was a little perplexed by your guest statement that he doesn't know why readers and those interested in Frost still think that he was a bit of a negative and jealous man, having the dark side. Maybe that's a better way to put it. And hasn't yet mentioned Lionel Trilling, I think it was, who said that Frost's poetry is terrifying. And another critics, take William Logan, for example, who I think effectively points out the darker aspects to Robert Frost's poetry. So I think I wonder if it's not possible to go too far the other direction.
All right, Patrick.
Obviously, like all of us, Frost was a complex man.
Sure. Well, let's give Donald Sheehy a chance to respond. Donald Sheehy, is The Letters of Robert Frost meant to be a counterpoint to Thompson's biography?
No. No. What happens, of course, is that early reviews, early accounts, descriptions of the book, people present their version of Frost and talk about how this book might or might not change that impression. We didn't intend, and we say in the preface that we don't have a biographical axe to grind. What we have is a desire that people read the letters that are there in front of them, and not go sort of selectively hunting through them for evidence of one kind or another. So that bringing Frost back into the focus that Thompson provided is the last thing that we would have wanted to happen. But of course, it inevitably does. And the second thing that the caller raised is a wonderful question about darkness in Frost's poetry. The danger is to connect necessarily one's metaphysical doubts or the darkness of a view of human nature or a vision of nature as chaos. One can have those types of philosophical concerns without them being the result necessarily of some deep distortion or tragic obsession in the life. So that I would not deny, and actually I'm happy to agree, that Trilling's view of Frost was a wonderful counterbalance to those people who read him as a consoling certainty, a kind of philosopher of continuity, which he also was. But Trilling is quite right to point out that there is real metaphysical darkness in Frost. But I think that we don't want to go too far in the direction of saying because we find the darkness of vision in the poems, mm-hmm. that necessarily means that his vision of life and his character is somehow dark in the same way.
Let's take another call. Andrew is calling from Cornwall. Andrew, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Years ago, I was lucky enough to put together a little book called The Rabbi and the Poet, Victor Reichert and Robert Frost. Mm. Victor Reichert was a rabbi who traveled from Ohio to Ripton, Vermont, where he used to preach sometime a little Unitarian church. And in this book, he gives a sermon, which had never before been printed, and which he gave in Rabbi Reichert's temple in 1946. And he begins it, I'll just be very brief. He says, "I've come here as a sort of exchange preacher with Rabbi Reichert. He has preached twice or three times in our little church in Ripton, Vermont. This is the second time I've stood in this pulpit, the first time to speak in the name of friendship and in the name of more than friendship, affection." And Rabbi Reichert comments on this sermon. He says, "The sermon became of vast importance for a variety of reasons. First, Lawrence Thompson's book on Frost had been reviewed on the front page of the New York Times Book Review. The review said that if you read the Thompson books, you'd never be able to stay in the same room with a monster like Frost." Hmm. So originated the monster myth. I can't read the whole sermon
sure.
to you. It's in the book. But this was Rabbi Reichert's opinion on what the sermon delivered in terms of the monster myth. And also in terms of his friendship with Rabbi Reichert.
Well, Andrew, thank you for sharing that. Boy, that's really interesting to hear, Donald Sheehy. Mm-hmm. So if this is a person who knew Frost and was surprised by the monster myth, kind of debunked it himself, what have you learned in the letters? Are there qualities that you find in Frost that are more endearing?
Well, Victor Reichert was one of many friends of Frost's of long standing. It says something about someone's character, I think, when friendships can last a lifetime. He also has a range of friendships that is extraordinary and shows that issues like religious difference or matters of economic position, et cetera, didn't determine how he felt about someone. What I would point out as most characteristic of Frost's personality is a kind of drive to engage. Even though he pulls back and lives a private life and talks about how difficult it is sometimes to maintain a balance between public and private, there's always in Frost this desire to converse, to persuade, to question, to examine. And I think what Reichert was absolutely correct in saying is that the man of the biography that Thompson produces is not the man that so many people so willingly sat in so many rooms talking with, listening to. He was extraordinarily engaged.
Now, Donald, we're just about out of time. Just want to ask you one final question. You spent a career studying and writing about Frost. So why does he continue to fascinate you?
Mostly the poems, of course. You can go back and read them and find something new or see a pattern or an issue that you hadn't realized was there before. There is an extraordinary complexity and depth beneath the simple surface of many of Frost's poems. Also, because he is never settled, he's always thinking, always weighing one side against the other, so that there is a real continual energy in Frost that pulls you back. And I have one question for you, Rick, before we finish.
Sure, we're just about out of time.
Okay. I want to know if you stopped and swung those birches.
I did not.
Oh, boy. You could have done
Fail.
A selfie, you know?
I know. I apologize. Donald Sheehy is the co-author of The Letters of Robert Frost and a professor of English at Edinburgh University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And coming up, we'll look at Russia's law against gay propaganda against the backdrop of the Olympic Games. That's just ahead on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, in for Jane Lindholm, who's on maternity leave. The Winter Olympics in Russia generated a lot of political debate in the months leading up to the Games. Among the criticism of Russia is a law that targets and suppresses expressions of gay pride. That's the focus of a recent article by Dartmouth College professor Jeff Charlotte. His story, Inside the Iron Closet, What It's Like to Be Gay in Putin's Russia, appears in this month's GQ magazine. Vermont Edition managing producer Patty Daniels spoke with Charlotte as the games in Sochi, Russia, were getting started.
Jeff, the Russian Duma passed a law last June that has become the focal point for the legal status of gays in Russia. Explain what that law does.
It's Article 6.21, and it's popularly known as the gay propaganda law, or rather the anti-gay propaganda law, forbidding propaganda to minors in the service of any sort of deviant sexualities. It doesn't say homosexuality. That's what it's understood by everyone to be. To date, there's only been a handful of prosecutions, but the real effect of the law is to drive people back into the closet, or in many cases, to drive them out of the country. There's been a sort of an exodus to make sort of show trials of queer people in Russia, LGBT people in Russia, to tell them that they are not welcome, and that worse than that, they are what the government is almost now calling the new enemies of the state.
And you profiled many people in your article who are trying to figure out how to live both in and out of the closet in Russia. Some of them you actually name. Some of them are anonymous. Some of them just go by first names in your article. But what is the range of opinion that they shared with you about how this law has impacted their lives?
You know, it was interesting. By day, I would go around and I would talk to activists and a whole range of activists. And they have sort of different political ideas, but we're all very uniform in saying that this is very big, very bad. It's getting much, much worse, just quicker than anybody could have imagined. And I would also talk to regular folks, people who weren't activists, people who were living hidden lives, closeted lives, suburban moms and dads. And they said the same thing. But at night, I would go out to the gay clubs that survived. There used to be a fairly thriving scene in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And there I would meet men especially who would say, oh, the law has no effect. I would meet men who would say the law is a good thing. Men who had been in the closet for so long and were so accustomed to it that they had come to believe in it. And then there was people, one man named Yuri, a middle-aged guy I met at a club called The Bunker, which is now essentially a place for men who live otherwise straight lives, married lives, and so on, to go and connect in the dark with one another, literally in the dark. But there's a small little bar, and I spoke to Yuri, and he said, no more pride parades. We can't ask for our rights anymore. This is Russia. He says, this is not Europe. This is Russia. He says, I will be beaten. You will be beaten. He gestures to another man. He will be beaten. We will be beaten. And we go to the police, and the police just smile.
And so was the sense you got one of fatalism?
Well, there's fatalism on the part of, people who have gotten used to the closet. But then there's these activists of astonishing courage. And there's a fatalism there, too. They know they'll be beaten. I mean, when this man says no more pride parades, a pride parade in Russia is not what we think of here. It can last maybe 2, maybe 3 minutes. You go, you meet at a prearranged place, you unfurl your flag, and you hold it until someone beats you down, and then the police arrest you for being beaten. That was your crime, being beaten. And yet, people go to these events. So that's not fatalism. It's a sort of a steely endurance. It's hard for us to quite imagine, but they're going to keep fighting.
You write a lot about physical violence in your article, and you interviewed several people who have been assaulted during gay pride parades, as you put it, or protests, or for simply attending social clubs or support groups. How prevalent is violence against gay people in Russia, or shaming of gay people in Russia?
If you're very, very closeted, you can't avoid it. I don't know how many dozens of people I spoke to there. It was a very small minority had not been beaten for their orientation at some point in their lives. If they were or had been out, because you have to remember, just a few years ago, things were just getting brighter and brighter every day for LGBT people in Russia. This is not some vestige of an old bigotry that rushes backward. This is a new thing. So people a few years ago, they'd still struggled. They'd been fired from their jobs. Everyone had been subject to violence, and it was so ordinary that no one led with the story. And that was what was really interesting. If you or I had been beaten for going to a demonstration, we would probably think that was a very big deal. It would come up in passing. It would come up an hour into the conversation. Someone would make a gesture to a jaw that had been broken, a nose that had been smashed, as if this was something that just happened to people.
And you write that that kind of violence has really accelerated in recent years. And you also write that it's taken on a politically charged form. And I want to ask you, Jeff, to explain how you characterize the connection between President Vladimir Putin's government and also the Russian Orthodox Church in fomenting this new brand of homophobia.
You know, there's a lot of very sort of establishment figures who say, what do you mean connection between Putin's government and the church? They're one and the same. Patriarch Kirill, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, long thought to have been associated with the KGB in the Soviet days, as of course was Putin. You know, they're old colleagues, and Kirill now speaks of Putin as he calls Putin an act of God. The leadership of the church, and there's dissidents within the church, of course, but the leadership of the church has sort of seen its angle to power. You have to remember that Putin came to office in 2000. for a while, he seemed to be bringing prosperity. He was riding the wave of oil dollars. He left. There was term limits and became prime minister, did a stint as prime minister so that he could then come back and be president. Even when he was prime minister, he was running the country. And when he came back in 2012, that's when all this sort of emerged. And homophobia, which had been there, like it is in any country, it became a political weapon. There's a big difference between just sort of a cultural bias and what we see now, where the state is actively campaigning against this, using homophobia to distract people from the fact that the oil money isn't flowing as smoothly as possible, to suggest that there's this enemy within. This is really important because I think we say, well, we have homophobia in America too, but we don't have it as a state policy. That's what's crucially different.
You mentioned Yelena Kostuchenko, who writes for Novaya Gazeta, and she put it to you that Putin needs internal enemies.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I heard this several times. I mean, this is always nationalist and demagogic politicians always look for internal enemies, right? But who should the internal enemy be? For much of Russian history, the internal enemy was easy. It was the Jews. Well, that's not kosher anymore after the Holocaust. And Putin makes a big show of his support for the few Jews that remain in Russia. At the beginning of his, I think it's fair to call it a regime at this point, the beginning of his regime, it was the Chechens. And, you know, they fought really two wars in that region. And they don't want it to go down that road. For a while, it was the immigrants, and there were street gangs beating immigrants with the sort of tacit approval of the police. But the immigrants were very well organized. And so you can almost imagine, and Elena sort of says, you sort of imagine them sitting around saying, well, who is it going to be? And then, you know, someone saying, I've got it, the gays. They're everywhere, but you don't know who they are. They look like everybody else, but they're different. We can use them to frighten people all the time.
We've been talking about homophobia in the context of modern Russia, and of course, it's not unique to Russia. Jeff Charlotte, why don't you put it in context for other similar movements that we've seen in other countries around the world?
Yeah, and they're really coming to the fore right now. Just recently, India recriminalized homosexuality. Uganda, they've already passed the so-called Kill the Gays bill. It's been watered down. Instead of death penalty now, it's just life imprisonment. And I've reported on these issues firsthand from Uganda, from Kenya, Russia, and the United States. And what's interesting is in all these places, you hear the same language. I mean, literally, whole phrases lifted, so much so that in Russia, I would be speaking with Russian nationalists, very anti-American, didn't speak English, but then they'd pepper their Russian speech with phrases like family values, traditional values, in those terms. So what they're doing is they're sort of taking these ideas from the American culture wars, amplifying them, making them much stronger, and use them, tap into the native homophobia of their country and turn it into a new political formation. That's really what's most frightening, and I think that's why we have to pay attention to what's happening in Russia, Eastern Europe, Africa, India, really around the planet.
We started this conversation, Jeff Charlotte, by talking about the law that was passed in June about propaganda. But many of the people you interviewed are actually more concerned with a second law that they expect will be passed this year. That's a bill that would make it illegal for gay and lesbian couples to have children. The people you interviewed expressed real fear for what would happen to their families if this law is passed. Describe what they told you.
Well, the law was introduced in October, and it would allow the government to take away children from queer families. It already has that power, and in fact, the gay propaganda law is being used by some people to blackmail queer families. You know, give us payments, or we're going to turn you in for propagandizing your own children by just letting them know you exist. But this law would be more formal. I mean, there's even a possibility that would create special branches of the police to look for these people. And the law was introduced in October and then kind of put to the side, but nobody, left, right, anywhere in the political spectrum, had any doubt that it was coming back after Sochi. That was the step too far that Putin didn't want to take while the world was watching. Everyone believes it will come back, and the question is how it will be used. Most of these laws, you have to remember, are not used to be radically enforced. They're used to make people hide.
The discussion of Russian politics really has receded since the Olympic competition has begun. Can you say, on balance, whether the Olympics have changed the circumstances of gay people in Russia?
You know, I think they have in a kind of surprising way. And among these activists, they said, look, this is our window of opportunity. When the world is watching, this is our chance. We need to gain as much ground as we can because it's going to get worse after this. There was a sense of people positioning themselves, building as many allies as they could. And I think they did a pretty good job. While NBC hasn't done what I had hoped, there's been more media on this than I think anybody expected. But it shows how much ground LGBT, I don't want to just say activists, LGBT people have made in Russia.
That's writer and journalist Jeff Charlotte. His article, Inside the Iron Closet, appears in this month's GQ magazine. And that's our show for today. Tomorrow we head to the butcher shop. The farm-to-table movement has encouraged a revival of the art of butchering meat. We'll learn more. I'm Rick Zingari. Thank you so much for listening.